Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay. So we're reading from chapter 15. Parashuram, the Lord's warrior incarnation. Okay. So I'm going to read the chapter introduction, and I'm going to read all the way through to text 10. And text 10 is the one we'll chant together. Okay? This chapter describes the history of Gaudi in the dynasty of Ila. From the womb of Urvasi came six sons named Ayu, Shutayu, Satyayu, Rai, Jai, Vijay. The son of Shutayu was Vasuman. The son of Satyayu was Shutanjaya. The son of Rai was Eka. The son of Jai was Amita. And the son of Vijay was Bhima. Bhima's son was named Kanchana. The son of Kanchana was Hotraka, and the son of Hotraka was Janu, who was celebrated for having drunk all the water of the Ganges in one sip. The descendants of Janu, one after another, were Puru, Balaka, Ajaka, and Kusha. The sons of Kusha were Kasumbu, Tanaya, Vasu, Kusanaba, and Kusanaba. From Kusanabu came Gaudi, who had a daughter named Satyavati. Satyavati married Richchika Muni, after the Munis contributed a substantial dowry. And from the womb of Satyavati by Richchika Muni, Jamadagni was born. The son of Jamadagni was Ram or Parashuram. When a king named Kartavir Arjuna stole Jamadagni's desire cow, Parashuram, who was ascertained by learned experts to be a Shaktivesh incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, killed Kartavir Arjuna. Later, he annihilated the Kshatriya dynasty 21 times. After Parashuram killed Kartavir Arjuna, Jamadagni told him that killing a king is sinful and that as a brahmana he should have tolerated the offense. Therefore, Jamadagni advised Parashuram to atone for his sin by traveling to various holy places. Okay, text 1. Sri Bhadarai Nirvacha Ailashya Kurvasi Garabat Sadasan Atmaja Nirpa Ayushutaya Satyaya Rayota Vijayo Jaya. Sukadeva Goswami continued, O King Prickett, this is the same thing again. From the womb of Urvasi, six sons were generated by Puru Rava. Their names were Ayu, Shutayu, Satyayu, Raya, Vijay, and Jai. I'll just read the translations, I think. The son of Shutayu was Vasuman. The son of Satyayu, Shutajanya. The son of Rai, Eka. The son of Rai, Eka. The son of Jai, Amita. And the son of Vijay, Bhima. The son of Bhima was Kanchana, the son of Kanchana was Hotraka, the son of Hotraka was Janu, who drank all the water of the Ganges in one sip. The son of Janu was Pudu, the son of Pudu was Balaka, the son of Balaka was Ajaka, the son of Ajaka was Kusha. Kusha had four sons named Kusumbu, Tanaya, Vasu, and Kasunaba. The son of Kasumbu was Gaudi. All right, we'll just read a little bit more. King Gaudi had a daughter named Satyavati, whom a Brahmin sage named Richchika requested from the king to be his wife. King Gaudi, however, regarded Richchika as an unfit husband for his daughter, and therefore he told the Brahmana, My dear sir, I belong to the dynasty of Kusha. Because we are aristocratic Kshatriyas, you have to give some dowry for my daughter. Therefore, bring at least 1,000 horses, each as brilliant as moonshine, and each having one black ear, whether right or left. Small purport. The son of King Gaudi was Vishvamitra, who was said to be a Brahmana and a Kshatriya combined. Vishvamitra attained the status of a Brahmarshi, as explained later. From the marriage of Satyavati and Richchika Muni came a son with the spirit of a Kshatriya. King Gaudi demanded that an uncommon request be fulfilled before the Brahmana Richchika could marry his daughter. Okay, reading on. When King Gaudi made this demand, the great sage Richchika could understand the king's mind. Therefore, he went to the demigod Varuna and brought from him the 1,000 horses that Gaudi had demanded. After delivering these horses, the sage married the king's beautiful daughter. Thereafter, Richchikamuni's wife and mother-in-law, each desiring a son, requested the Muni to prepare an oblation. Thus, Richchikamuni prepared an oblation for his wife with a Brahman mantra and another for his mother-in-law with a Kshatriya mantra. Then he went out to bathe. Meanwhile, because Satyavati's mother thought that the oblation prepared for her daughter, Richchika's wife, must be better, she asked her daughter for that oblation. Satyavati therefore gave her own oblation to her mother and ate her mother's oblation herself. Small, short purport. A husband naturally has some affection for his wife. Therefore, Satyavati's mother thought that the oblation prepared for Satyavati by the sage Richchika must have been better than her own oblation. In Richchika's absence, the mother took the better oblation from Satyavati and ate it. Okay, so now text 10. Got it? Tadviditva muni praha. Tadviditva muni praha. Patnim kastam akarashi. Patnam kastam akar rashi. Goro danda dara putro. Goro danda dara putro. Bratate brahma vittama. Bratate brahma vittama. Tadviditva muni praha. Patnim kastam akar rashi. Goro danda dara putro. Bratate brahma vittama. Others. Anybody? Muni praha. Vaishnavis. tat, this fact, viditva, having learned, muni, the great sage, praha, said, patnim, unto his wife, kastam, very regrettable, akarashi, you have done, gora, fierce, dandadara, a great personality who can punish others. Putra, such a son. Brata, brother. Te, your. Brahmavitama, a learned scholar in spiritual science. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. When the great sage, Richchika, returned home after bathing and understood what had happened in his absence, he said to his wife, Satyavati, you have done a great wrong. Your son will be a fierce kshatriya, able to punish everyone, and your brother will be a learned scholar in spiritual science. Purport. A brahmana is highly qualified when he can control his senses and mind, when he is a learned scholar in spiritual science, and when he is tolerant and forgiving. A kshatriya, however, is highly qualified when he is fierce in giving punishment to wrongdoers. These qualities are stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, text 42 and 43. Because Satyavati, instead of eating her own oblation, had eaten that which was meant for her mother, she would give birth to a son imbued with the kshatriya spirit. This was undesirable. The son of a brahmana is generally expected to become a brahmana, but if such a son becomes fierce like a kshatriya, he is designated according to the description of the four varnas in Bhagavad Gita, Chaturvana Mayastrastam Guna Karma Vibhagasha. If the son of a brahmana does not become like a brahmana, he may be called a kshatriya, vaishya, or sudra, according to his qualification. The basic principle for dividing society is not a person's birth, but his qualities and actions. So this last sentence sort of says it all. The basic principle for dividing society is not a person's birth, but his qualities and actions. That's really significant. So just recapping a little bit what we've heard. So Gaudi, the father of Satyavati, he was not happy when Richchika Muni wanted to try to marry his daughter. Initially, he wasn't happy. Why? Well, he was a kshatriya. He was a king. And, you know, the kshatriyas are proud of being kshatriyas. The brahmins are proud of being brahmins. The vaishyas are proud of being vaishyas. And even sudras are proud of being sudras. And there's also some practical things involved, too, that, you know, as a kshatriya, he has certain duties to perform like that. So here's this spaced out Muni coming to, you know, want to marry his daughter, and he was, you know, he didn't want to really give his daughter to the Muni, and he set some condition, you know, okay, well, you know, if he shows some prowess in some way, then I'll do it. And of course he was able to. He got the 1,000 horses from Varuna, and then he handed his daughter over. But, you know, initially he wasn't enthusiastic about it, because he was a kshatriya, and I guess he wanted a kshatriya son-in-law as opposed to a Muni son-in-law. I know this is like a philosophical speculation area. I'm just trying to understand how the whole thing works. But and also we see that Richchika Muni, when he found out that his wife drank the it wasn't her fault really, it was her mother's fault. But when she took the wrong oblation, and as a result of that, she was going to wind up having a son with a kshatriya spirit, you know, a fierce son, as opposed to he wasn't happy about that. He wanted a brahminical son, like that. So, you know, so as we can see, that, you know, it's practical too. I mean, as I said, these, you know, kshatriyas have to perform certain duties, brahmins have to perform certain duties, as described here in this purport. They're very different. You know, the brahmin, as I said, is qualified when he's a learned scholar in spiritual science, can control his mind and senses, he's tolerant and forgiving. But a kshatriya, he's qualified when he's fierce in giving punishment to wrongdoers. So, you know, different qualities and activities are required from people in different divisions of the society. So, that's significant. So, once again, as Prabhupada says here, the basic principle for dividing society is not a person's birth, but his qualities and actions. And that holds true for just not, material society and spiritual, everything, right across the board. This principle is applicable, that what's really important is the person's qualities and actions and not the social status. I remember in the how this applies to us, because that's the whole idea, is we're trying to get lessons from the Bhagavatam, what can we learn from this? Well, in the first Back to Godhead magazine I read, and Judah Karma read this Back to Godhead magazine too. I don't know if it was his first one he read, but it was my first one. I got it in Port Authority bus station back in, I guess, either early 1973 or 1972, as I was coming back from a rained-out camping trip. And some Matajis approached me, and gave me that and something else, and I gave him a donation anyway. So I read it. It was one of these, which to this day they still have one of these interviews with Prabhupada. Prabhupada's on a walk with some devotees and disciples, well, aspiring disciples, and they asked him, Srila Prabhupada, when can we become initiated? And Prabhupada's answer was, you're already initiated. As soon as one is serious to follow my instructions, that is initiation. Now, I know that's not the only thing Prabhupada ever said about initiation, and it would be, very unbalanced to suggest that, that's it. That's the way to understand initiation, is just being serious to follow Prabhupada's instruction. No, there's so many different statements about initiation, and there's so many different shastric statements one could find to support the importance of the formal initiation as well. But anyway, I don't think that what I just said was an anomalous remark, and it's, certainly it's there. Prabhupada said it, and it has some importance that he, at least on that occasion, he was emphasizing the important thing was the person's willingness, execution of the instructions, the willingness to perform the instructions. That is the initiation, you see? And just to support this point that this is not an anomalous, statement, I just found something very good from the Nectar Devotion, which I will read to, that kind of supports this. Srila Rupa Goswami warns, however, that if a person is properly initiated by a bona fide spiritual master, he should not think that simply by acceptance of such initiation, his business is then finished. One still has to follow the rules and regulations very carefully. If after accepting the spiritual master and being initiated, one does not follow the rules and regulations of devotional service, then he is again fallen. I'll read that sentence again. If after accepting the spiritual master and being initiated, one does not follow the rules and regulations of devotional service, then he is again fallen. One must be very vigilant to remember that he is part and parcel of the transcendental body of Krishna, and that it is his duty as part and parcel to give service to the whole or Krishna. If we do not render service to Krishna, then again we fall down. In other words, simply by becoming initiated, does not elevate one to the position of a high-class brahmana. One also has to discharge the duties and follow the regulative principles very rigidly. Yeah, so, very clear that what's important is following the instructions, that willingness to actually follow the instructions. And this is an important point because there have been problems with this, this very type of thing throughout in Vaishnav history. And historically speaking, there's quite a few instances that can be mentioned, but one that comes to my mind most is that there's something called back around the time, after the departure of Lord Chaitanya, there's something called the Nityananda Vamsa. Nityananda Vamsa were personalities who were claiming some sort of seminal relationship with Lord Nityananda, and therefore they were saying that they were like, hereditary caste Brahmin, caste Goswamis. No, they were saying that because we are the descendants of Lord Nityananda, we are the people who should be able to, we're the real, Goswamis, and we're the people who should be able to, award Brahminical status or et cetera to other personalities. And they basically were claiming that an exclusive right to do that. And, but the thing was, First of all, their actual, even their hereditary lineage was questionable. And aside from that, they didn't have the qualities of, you know, of a bona fide Goswamis or spiritual masters like that. So anyway, there was a prolonged Bhaktisiddhanta Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master got into a sort of a knockdown drag out battle with them, and he emerged victorious. But you know, that was a big thing that he was, you know, that he had to establish that these people are bogus. That's not the correct understanding. You know, it's not a matter of social status like that, that somebody is, you know, represents Vaishnavism. It's based on the qualities, and he was able to, you know, establish that. But after, as I said, a long battle. And another example of this is you know, this principle is even Prabhupada's own family. You know, Prabhupada's own family is his, you know, except for his sister, the rest of the family were not, you know, strict practicing Vaishnavas. And consequently, the members of ISKCON, you know, never really, you know, showed them any kind of special respect or anything like that. Of course, you know, we were respectful to everybody, but they didn't have any kind of special status among the Vaishnav community because simply, why? For that reason, because they weren't practicing Vaishnavas. So even though they were Prabhupada's own family members, children, wife, children like that, so because of that, they, you know, were just considered like ordinary people. So once again, the important thing is, you know, how we're following the instructions, you know, what we're actually, how much we're trying to surrender. And that's what, you know, should be, that's what's important, not the social status. And, of course, you know, speaking to, like, this audience, I mean, people here are trying to do that, and that's why we're here. That's why we're here attending Bhagavatam class and, you know, doing all the things we're doing. And that's good. And that's what's actually important. And in order to do that, you know, whatever it takes for an individual to do that is authorized. In other words, Prabhupada was you know, very how would you say, broad-minded on this principle. There's one purport in the eighth canto, where he explains that, you know, he makes a clear distinction, what's more important, you know, and in this particular purport he emphasizes that what's important is not giving up the fight against Maya, you know, doing whatever you have to do to stay strong and be able to execute Krishna consciousness. He makes the point that it's much better to be a grihastha, you know, who's following the devotional practices, than to be a so-called, you know, sannyasi who's unable to do so like that. There's no credit to be in the transcendental, a sannyas, for instance, or supposedly in the transcendental position, and that you're not able to follow properly. So, you know, in this particular purport, Prabhupada says, the soldiers in the Krishna conscious movement must always possess physical strength, enthusiasm, and sensual power. So does everybody here feel like they feel physically strong, enthusiastic, and sensually powerful? Hope so. But, yeah. But if you're not, Prabhupada says, but what constitutes a normal condition will not be the same for everyone. So in other words, there's a bit of a license here. And this is such an important point, you know, that you have to be, everybody has to be in a position where they can follow. And Prabhupada's actually, you know, making not a concession, but he's, you know, giving a license. He's saying that he's acknowledging that what constitutes a normal condition will not be the same for everyone. So in other words, it's kind of like saying, you got do what you got to do, but you got to follow. You know, somebody, you know, for instance, just like health, for instance. For some people, health is not an issue. They have good health. They've got good karma for health, and it's just not a problem. You know, they just get up and they feel plenty of energy and they feel good and they just go through a day. And they, you know, the next day they take rest that evening and they get up the next morning, it's the same thing. And for other people, it's like a real big issue. You know, unless they do different things, you know, unless they're really careful about their diet, unless they make sure they get such and such exercise or this or that, they just can't function. They're going right down the tube. So there's kind of like an example of that. But that's okay. You got to do what you got to do. Another example is maybe earning a livelihood. For some people, you know, they just they have good karma for money. They just have it. They have it from their family, or they just seem to be able to manage to find work, or get somehow or another it just comes to them. Somebody else, it's a real struggle. So in the same way, you got to do what you got to do, you know. But as Prabhupada says here, one must continue to fight with Maya with great strength. One should not give up the fighting and go away. So that's there too. You know, in other words, on this point of the qualities and the activities that we have to perform the devotional activities, the sadhana bhakti, and also we have to. It's everybody's individual responsibility to make sure you do what you need to do so that you can be in that position, so you can execute these devotional activities, so that you can minimally chant 16 rounds, follow the four regular principles, and ideally beyond that, you know, come to the temple more often than not often, you know, and participate as much as possible. So, you know, that's everybody's responsibility. And Prabhupada's talking, he refers to the members of the Krishna conscious movement here as soldiers. He says the soldiers in this Krishna conscious movement must always possess those things. So soldiers means like there's, you know, it's like used, you know, word that's used in relation to like a military effort or something like that. So, yeah, this is, and he also elsewhere in that Prabhupada used the word fight against Maya. It's like sometimes he would refer to engaging in devotional service as like declaring war against the illusory energy. So in this fight with Maya, or this war against the illusory energy, or the soldiers of the Krishna consciousness, one of the main weapon, you know, is book distribution, distributing Prabhupada's books. There's one statement in the 10th canto, second chapter of Prabhupada, says, in our Krishna conscious movement, all our activities are concentrated upon distributing Krishna literature. So that's our main weapon, you know, in this fight against Maya, or this war against the illusory energy, the distribution of Krishna literature. So what does that mean? You know, in our Krishna conscious movement, all our activities are concentrated upon distributing Krishna literature. Does that mean that everybody has to be a book distributor? No, it doesn't. What it means is that everybody should be conscious of what's going on here, that we are engaged collectively in a fight against war against the illusory energy, as Prabhupada would say, and that's our weapon. You know, that's our main weapon. So everybody has to support the effort. Just like if the United States, in time of war, in a country, not everybody's expected to be a soldier. Not everybody's expected to come forward and actually, you know, grab a rifle and go out there, or whatever they grab these days. But everybody's expected to be a patriotic citizen and support the war effort, you see? So that's what's required. And actually, you know, I think that's the understanding of what that means, that in our Krishna conscious movement, all our activities are concentrated upon distributing Krishna literature. And actually, I think that's going on here in New Dwarka to a very significant extent. And I'll give an example of why I say that. For instance, here in New Dwarka, in less than a year, one of our members here has distributed 85 sets of Srimad Bhagavatam and 25 sets of Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's a lot. That's Gaurasundar Prabhu. So, Hari Bol, Jai. Now, you know, he's done that. He's actually like the head of the spear. He's the guy who actually kind of, you could say, shot the bullet and actually did it. But, you know, could he have done that if the people, you know, who he's engaged like this, if when they came to the temple, if they saw that, all the artiks were late and the temple was dirty and the deities were, you know, not dressed nicely and the prashanam was stale and, you know, when they went to the restaurant, it wasn't clean and things didn't taste good. And follow what I'm saying? You know, no. And they had a good experience. He's able to do what he's doing because, on the whole, when the people come here, they have a good experience. You know, they're seeing the places, you know, the grounds are nice, everything's, you know, taken care of, clean, organized. They come into the temple, it's clean, and the deities look beautiful. They go to the restaurant, same thing. They're having an overall good experience, and he's very expert by Krishna's mercy. You know, we're very fortunate to have him here in New Dwarka. Again, he's been doing this service for like over, you know, for 42 years, and he's just kind of focused on that, just one thing, making members, selling sets of books. And he's, you know, actually able to bring, you know, get the fruit. You know, everybody else is doing all this hard work and doing all these other things, and which is required, and we have somebody who can kind of like, you know, boom, deliver the punch, so to speak, and engage these people. So that's good. So we're doing that. You know, we're doing that here in New Dwarka. And another evidence of that is another one of our Sankirtan devotees, Gauranga Prema. He's right over there. He's here, and he loves New Dwarka. He's so happy to be here. He doesn't want to go back to China because, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because he sees that he likes what he experiences here. He feels like encouraged by the atmosphere here. He finds it much easier to be a devotee, you know, because of the program and everything like that. And so once again, you see, here's somebody who's, you know, is another kind of an example how the whole temple, everybody's part, you know, contributing to the atmosphere of the temple, and you know, he's an example, evidence of how it's working, because you know, he's encouraged, he's very enthusiastic. On his days off, he goes out to Comic-Con and distributes, you know, 250 books and collects a lot of Lakshmi. When it's the weekend, he didn't even have to do that. So that's another example. And I'm an example in a funny kind of way. I'm trying to develop the traveling program here, but the temple's so nice, the atmosphere is so nice here that I'm having a hard time getting devotees to go out traveling. Everybody wants to stay back and do Sankirtan based in New Dwarka. So anyway, it's very good, and so we're doing the right thing. You know, a lot of times when somebody talks about book distribution, everybody, you know, people feel guilty because, well, I'm not doing book, you know, definitely don't want to be one of these people who's making everybody feel uncomfortable about, you know, that they're not out there handing somebody a book. And Prabhupada says here it's concentrated on book distribution, and that's my understanding of what that means, that everybody's contributing. You know, everybody's contributing. Whatever your service is, you're contributing. Either you're contributing to Gaurasundar, selling people, the guests that are coming, sets of Bhagavatams or Chaitanya Charitamritas, or you're contributing to the, you know, to the enthusiasm and you know, enthusiasm of the book distributors, because you know they get so much from all the support, from the nice morning program, from the prasadam that's always on time, and you know, nice, you know, good quality and everything, all the other things that are happening here. So that's good. And just one last point that actually I did a count this morning just before the class, and we have actually 15 devotees, at least 15 devotees that go out on a regular daily basis. And I remember from back when I was in the 340 West 55th Street building, temple in New York, back in the 1975, 6 and 7. And be honest with you, there weren't more Sankirtan devotees. That was a temple of like minimum 100 to 200 devotees who lived in the temple, you know, fluctuated. And probably, like, you know, say, average 150. And really, the Sankirtan party was, if it was that many, it was, you know, it wasn't any more. It was only about, you know, same thing, about 15 Sankirtan devotees. So pretty good that, you know, here in 2015, where you have a Sankirtan team that's comparable in size to, you know, to the famous skyscraper building, as Prabhupada would say, in New York. And you know, when everything was, things were supposedly in their heyday, so that's pretty good. That's pretty good. It's pretty nice. It's kind of like a feather in the cap to New Dwarka. But of course, we can't rest on our laurels. We have the marathon coming up. This is like, you know, November. After November is December, and so everybody can kind of be you know, kind of starting to think about that, and you know, what you want to do for the marathon, where you want to go, and like that. So we're going to have another successful marathon. Actually, be nice to once again have New Dwarka be number one in North America. I think at the moment we're kind of like in the lead at the moment, and we'd like to keep that and have another, you know, successful year like that. So anyway, I'll stop there. 8:15. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Thank you, Brigapati. Nice presentation. And from the position you're in, how do you think that we can improve in book distribution, individually and collectively?
Okay. Well, one big improvement I've seen over the, just over the last few months is that some of the devotees have started doing tabling, and that's been a big improvement. Bichai's been doing it for 24 years, and at least myself, I was just too stubborn to really, you know, take advice from him. He was encouraging us to do it, but we were very fond of our other method, you know, just kind of roaming around with a rolling backpack. But it seems people feel more comfortable. You know, when you plunk their table down, it just makes you look, it gives you more credibility. And they come up, a lot of people, we have what's called walk-ups. They just walk right up to the table. And those people are very receptive. And they, you know, take a lot of books sometimes and give very nice donations. And you don't get that when you're just roaming around with a bag. You know, people are, it's kind of like you can't tell, because especially when you know, when you've been doing it for a long time, you're so comfortable with it that you don't pick up on the other person's apprehension. But I guess there's just always that little bit of like a uneasiness. What's going on here? Who is this guy? Or what's happening here, you know? But when you're at a table, they're used to that, because that's how other people conduct business, so to speak. They're at a table, they have a sign, you know, that's been a big improvement, and that makes it a lot easier. It takes a lot of pressure off the distributors. I think that a lot of new people, you know, people who are kind of feeling that I don't know if I could do this, you know, because I'm kind of a shy person. When you have the support of the table there, it can make it a lot easier. It definitely will make it a lot easier, and it's just, you can preach better. It's just, the whole thing is a better atmosphere altogether. So that's a big thing. And it's a technique, but it seems to be helping tremendously, you know, improve the quality and the quantity of book distribution. Yeah, Arjuna?
Hare Krishna. Thank you for your presentation. You're glorifying different individuals and the Sankirtan effort in general, but we know that everything starts with good management. Things don't happen accidentally. Like Gaurasundar Prabhu, you gave him as an example. He's extremely organized. We can all see that. His, you know, his Sunday presentation is there hours in advance, and everything is pukka. All the books are lined up, and the maha is there, and he has his assistants. Everything very nicely organized. But somehow or other, it seems that when it comes to the marathon every year, for those who don't go out regularly, things are not properly organized. I've been noticing that for decades now here in New York. So I think the onus is more on the regular Sankirtan devotees to really help in that regard. Because you're used to being very organized every day. You know where you're going, how you're getting there, and what you're taking, and how many books you have, and very organized. But when it comes to the marathon, those who don't usually go out are left on their own to decide where they're going and what they're going to do. I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Completely wrong. Somebody needs to take charge of organizing the marathon to a fine degree. Okay, you're a pujari and now you're going to go out for 2 weeks. Here's where you're going to go. Here's your table. Here's your books. Organize it. Don't just leave it up to those who don't go out regularly to organize themselves. That doesn't work very nicely.
Okay, that's a good comment. So that's a little job for me, I guess. Yeah, Sachin Mahaprabhu.
Yeah, that was a good point. Sometimes, like, for example, like suggestion, you've been going out with one devotee who's been successful in this. You can be going with other different younger devotees. He already knows how to do that. He doesn't need, you know, more advice, but you can tell the other devotees how to do it. And just a suggestion. You know, I have a question. In regards to, you know, tables, when you have a table, I've seen, you know, in many colleges and universities, many other people set tables, like Jehovah's Witnesses, they have tables there. Nobody comes to see them. Would you think that if they put a sign, they have also pamphlets and books, if they put the sign, the same sign that we have, people would go there and get something?
No. It, you know, we do more than just, I mean, there are, as I said, when you put the table down and you have a sign, we have a sign that says free meditation books. We're having a bunch of new signs made that are going to say yoga and meditation books, because Vijay, our world minister, felt that he didn't like that. He wasn't comfortable with that. He felt that's a little bit misleading. So we're going to go with yoga and meditation books. But I'm pretty sure the results are going to be the same. You have to have the sign. The table is there. You have to have the sign. Sign helps. But, you know, also you have to call people over. And that's not hard. I mean, we're doing college campuses, so you just use a qualifying question. Say, excuse me, are you first year or second year? If it's a two-year college. And then they say, whatever. And so, what's your major? And then whatever they say, so, okay, you're qualified. Come on over. Yeah, and they come. And if it's it's a four-year university, you just say, are you graduate or undergraduate? And they say, what's your major? And they say, okay, you're qualified. Come on over. So you know, some people just walk up on their own just from seeing the sign, and other people you just, you know, call them over by a qualifying question, and you just bring them over. So
if you wouldn't put the sign, no sign at all, and you have the table, even if you call them, they might not come, right?
Well, they may not, but I think they will.
Because of the sign makes an impact. It's like free, and everybody goes.
No, I don't think I don't think that's what's doing it. They're interested in not free. They're interested in meditation. We get, you know, we do get people coming and say, really? Are these free? And so that, you know, but I don't think it's, I mean, it's not like it's the only reason these people are walking up to the table is because the sign says free meditation books. You know, they're interested. They're interested in meditation. They're interested to see what's going on. Anyway, we'll see. You know, as I said, Ratna Bhushan's making a bunch of new signs that are going to say yoga and meditation books. And we'll see how that works. But I think it's going to be pretty similar. That's my suspicion. One last comment or question, and then we'll wrap it up. Okay. Yeah. Well. Okay. Do we have one last? Somebody want to make? Okay. Back the storm, and then that's it. So. Oh, sorry. Did somebody over there have their hand up earlier? Sure.
The books are so much more beautiful than the textbooks that they pay $150 for, and they're already programmed. I buy books. I'm a student. I buy books. That's what I'm here for. I buy books. I read books. I study books. So when they look at our books, they're like, oh, you know, it's just, and then I think one thing that really attracts them to the table is just the beauty of the books, and also if you're really seriously praying, you're like asking Krishna, please help them to come over, and you say, hey, I got something for you, and you know, they feel like, oh, here's somebody who's really, you know, here for me, you know, who really wants to, you know, interact with me. A lot of those kids, I really feel sorry for them because they're in such a bad space. You know, it's the educational institutions in the United States are really not doing them a favor. They're taking so much money from them and not giving them what they need to go along in life. Another thing I want to mention is if somebody who's running the school, a professor or a faculty member or a student service person, comes to the table, be sure to give them a good deal. Don't let them feel like you're there to make money. You know, it could come in the next so many years that they'll make some kind of overall monopoly at all the campuses that we can only be there for like 30 minutes. I mean, I saw it happen to the airport. I saw it happen to the DMV. So be very cordial and be the representative.
Yeah.
And also, I've seen the Jehovah's Witnesses bring lots and lots of people over their tables because they have this mood of making a congregation out of the people that come to the table. They're really into making converts. And so you see them writing the people's names down and doing contact information. And, you know, they're very, some of their representatives are really, really powerful, I've noticed. So, it's not that they're always not getting people to come to their table. They do, and they do a real congregational effort with it. So, anyway. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great comment. Okay, so we'll wrap it up. Thank you. Grantara Chima Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Sometimes I just wave to people.